I'm Ben.
Nice to meet you.
What's your name?
Joseph.
Nice to meet you.
So we're counting up from the bottom of Lamed Aleph, Amud Beis. Five lines. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Shalashera. Let's just review the last point that we made yesterday, which is not really relevant, but it's always good to do a chazara. That is that according to Rabbi Yehuda, Esro doesn't require Hada. And that's the Pella. Amazing chiddush that even though the Torah defines and describes the Esro as creates hadar, but the word hadar doesn't mean what you think it means and what as it appears in the translations. But rather the word hadar means hadar ba'ilan mishana l'shana. Now I don't know if anybody was able to go online and find out if there's any other fruit that lives on the tree and grows from one year to the next. No, okay. I guess my appeal fell on deaf ears.
Yeah, I looked, but it was... Most of the articles did not deal with that. It wasn't so easy to dig that out. Maybe my search terms would
be right. We have to ask a botanist.
Yeah.
But there is something which we call, I think it's Yiddish or maybe it's Polish, boxer. In Hebrew it's called charuvim. I think in English it's called charub or something like that.
Carob tree.
So the carob tree is very interesting. It's close to the Esrog tree, but not exactly the same. Because the carob tree, what happens is that it could stay on the tree for quite a while, but usually it says in the books that after a year it starts falling off the tree. It stays whole even off the tree. Again, you and I might not want to eat it. We used to eat it on one day of the year. You know, Tu B'Shvat. Did you call Jerry Boxer when you were here? Yeah, Boxer. I know what language is that? I don't know. But in Hebrew it's called Charuvim. And in the laws of Zeroyim, Charuvim has a special role to play. A very interesting, complicated dinim about Shvius on a Charuv tree. All right, anyway, Charuvim. Today, by the way, if you are cutting down on your sugars, and instead of chocolate, you want to use a spread, they have Carob spread. Have you seen it? Yes. It's supposed to be quite good. All right. Now we have the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that a lulav shel asherah is possible. And an asherah is a tree that was worshipped. As we mentioned many times in the past, it was common pagan culture, to worship trees. And in this case, the tree was a date palm tree. And a lulav was taken from that tree. And the question is, can you use the lulav for the mitzvah of l'kachtem lachem, of the dalad bina? So what we're going to learn about today is a principle called Kitusei Mechta Shiura. Are you familiar with this? If not, you should write it down. This is a real shas sugya. Kitusei Mechtas Shiura. Okay, now, this is a double language, really, just to give it extra emphasis. But Mechtas means it's completely pulverized, like destroyed. Okay? Now, when we're saying that it's destroyed, I'm going to just ask you a very childish question, but I just make sure you get it right, and I can take my question seriously. Don't say, oh, Rabbi Rosen doesn't want an answer because it's such a simple question. But when I say that this object is destroyed, do I mean A, physically destroyed, or B, legally destroyed?
Legally
destroyed. It means alpi din. Al-pi-din. No one should begin to imagine that this lulav was actually destroyed. Otherwise, he wouldn't shake it as a lulav. So the lulav is perfectly intact. Nothing has changed. But Kitusei Mechta Shiura said it's considered destroyed. Legally, according to the halacha, it's considered destroyed. And if it's destroyed, its non-existence generates what's called the absence of a shiur. Shiur means a minimum size, right? And in the case of a lulav, although the Mishnah is a little bit confusing on this point, but for our purposes, we'll oversimplify it and say that the shear of a lulav is four tefachim. And if it's completely destroyed, I don't have the four tefachim. So the whole sugya that we're going to learn now revolves around this one question. Is there an object, in our case a lulav, which although you look at it and it's perfect, it's beautiful, it's you know, you can impress your neighbor that you have the most beautiful lulav, but believe it or not, as tall as it is, it's completely destroyed. Legally. So your naked eye is misleading you, because what you have to look at is you have to put on these special, you know, three-dimensional glasses that are halachic glasses. So when you put on these halachic spectacles, what you're going to see is a totally destroyed object, which means that it has no shear. And that's called kitusei mefta shiura. Now, under what circumstances do we apply the principle of kitusei mefta shiura? So the most radical, or the most basic case is what's called omeid l'sreifa. Omeid l'sreifa means that the Torah requires that you burn it. Now, the truth is that as a general rule, avodah zarah doesn't have to be burned. There's no mitzvah of sreifa on avodah zarah. If a guy worships an idol, you don't have to burn the idol. But you may have to destroy it in some other fashion. For example, one of the classical ways of destroying avodah zarah is called gniza, okay? Otherwise known as nikbarim. Again, it depends which sugi in shas, and different sugis all over the place, but it means it has to become totally inaccessible. And once again, we're going to apply in these cases the principle of ketusei mefta shiura, but that's already a lower level of ketusei mefta shiura. The classical extreme level, or the most profound case of is the classical omeid l'sreifa case, where the Torah requires you to burn. Now, there's a very small slice of Jewish history, a period in which this concept of omeid l'sreifa applies to avodah zarah. And that is when Yoshua crosses the Jordan River to destroy the seven nations that occupy the land, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I would call them the Palestinians, but today that has a whole different meaning. But if you take it out of our historical context, you know, the original Palestinians. So the Torah says, Lo sechayah kol neshama, you know, we have a mitzvah of destroying them. And not only do we have to destroy them, but we have to destroy their idols. And if they worship the tree, that tree has to be destroyed in a very specific way. The Torah says, Ba'esh tisrafun. This is a parasha, I think, in Re'eh, if I remember correctly, Mitzi will correct me. And the Torah requires that you burn this. But again, that's a very small slice of history. So the word Asherah in our Mishnah, Bipashtu, said, you know, at first glance, it doesn't refer to any specific historical period. That would be a real push. It refers to any tree, even today. Let's say there's a date palm tree across the street, Lomazogin, and a guy would worship that date palm tree. The lulav, says the Mishnah, is possible. And the reason for that is because Kintusei Mechta Shiura is going to apply, because we view the lulav as if it's destroyed, even though, again, in this case, we don't need sreifa. So I don't know if I can apply this principle of omei l'sreifa, but I can apply a lower principle. Now, Rabosai, you know, I define this shiur from 8:30 to 9:30 as Gemara Rashi and selected Tosfos. The problem with selected Tosfos is going to come to the fore today. Because in order to really understand this sugya, you have to take a look at the Tosfos on the bottom of Lamed Aleph Amid Beis, Dibra Maslil Ba'asherah. Do you see that Tosfos? And it looks innocuous, right? How many lines is it? It's only about four lines, right? That's a trick of the eye. This is one of the longest Tosfos in Shas, because it keeps going and going endlessly. So we would be here for a month. But on the other hand, I can't leave this Tosfos out because it really breaks open the sugya. So what we're going to try to do today, and I apologize, it's not our classical Gemara Rashi and Tosfos here. We're going to just go through the Gemara Rashi and then try to summarize the highlights of this Tosfos. And it goes like this. Our Mishnah that passes a lulav of Asherah seems to contradict Rava. What's the statement of Rava? So the Gemara says, v'shalasher apostle, is the Mishnah telling me that a lulav shalasher is possible? Now notice that the Mishnah actually has two cases. It has a lulav shalasher, and it also has iranidachas. The case of iranidachas is a very simple case, relatively, because there it's omik l'sreipa. The halacha is that the entire city has to be completely destroyed. That's called an iranidachas, where most of the Jewish population in that city worshipped an idol, or worshipped idols. But we're focused now on the first case in the Mishnah, namely lulav shel asherah. And the Mishnah equates lulav shel asherah with a lulav shel iranidachas. And that's going to be a problem for Rava, because Rava is going to assume that as a general rule, a lulav of avodah zarah is kosher. Again, when I say it's kosher, it doesn't mean that I'm going to encourage you to use it, but if you use it, you yotze the mitzvah. And the reason for that is because Rava is unwilling to apply the principle of ketusei mechtesh yura in this case, because this is a case where a guy worships a tree, and that avodah zarah is not subject to the rule of ketusei mechtesh yura. But why not? The Mishnah says a lulav shel asherah is possible. V'amar Rava lulav shel avodah zarah lo yitol, which means that lechatchilo, if you ask me, I would discourage you from using it. But v'im natal, what's the din according to Rava?
Kosher.
So how do you reconcile Rava with our Mishnah? Meaning, Rava seems to say that we don't apply the principle of ketusei mechtesh yura to the case of a lulav shel avodah zarah. The Mishnah says that an asherah, a lulav shel asherah, is possible. Now, Rabosai, if you wanted to guess, you sort of guess the Gemara's answer. This is what we used to, when we were young kids and learning Gemara as youngsters, we used to try to cover the Gemara and try to come up with our own answer and see if by any chance we hit it on the mark. So if I would cover the next Gemara's answer, just on a linguistic level, what difference do you see between the formulation of Rava and our Mishnah, just linguistically?
Well, Rava's issue is not with the avodah zarah, but he's not saying...
Well, no, Rava says lulav shel avodah zarah. It says
no, but I'm saying his understanding of why a shera might be possible might have a different reason than avodah zarah. He might not have.
Oh, you mean he thinks that a shera has nothing to do with avodah zarah? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he might hold that it's true that a shera is possible.
This I have to give you a linguistic analysis here. The word asherah, anywhere you find it, means avodah zarah. But linguistically, what are the two terms here? Yeah, Jerry?
I'm saying he draws the distinction.
No, I'm asking. There are two words here. There's Rava. Rava says lulav shel avodah zarah is b'dieved, right? In natal kosher. The Mishnah says asherah, lulav shel asherah.
Right.
So what linguist, just without using your brains, you know, this is a brainless exercise. What's the difference linguistically between our Mishnah and Rava? Rava uses the term avodah zarah. The Mishnah uses the term asherah. And now the question is there any difference? Because I told you that by definition asherah means it was worship, but maybe it's not just a lulav shel avodah zarah, but it's an asherah shel avodah zarah. Is there a difference between a lulav that was used as part of an idolatrous cult and an idolatrous service, and an asherah, which means a tree of lulavim, and then the lulav takes on the status, according to our Mishnah, of avodah zarah, of the asherah, and maybe the asherah is different? So if you take a look at the Gemara's answer, then we're going to come back and take this and pick apart this Gemara from the start. The Gemara says that Hacha, our Mishnah, is talking about Asherah de Moshe. In other words, once the Mishnah deliberately used the word Asherah, I can add another word to Asherah and tell you that we're talking about Asherah de Moshe. Askinon means that's the case. So if you take a look at Rashi, about eight lines up from the bottom, Rashi says, Asherah de Moshe, Osam, those trees, Shahayu b'shas kibush Eretz Yisrael, that were growing in the land of Israel at the time of the conquering of the land. It's interesting because was Moshe around during the conquering of the land? No. But they gave him a covenant and they called it Asherah de Moshe. Moshe brought him to the boundary, but he never crossed over the Jordan into Eretz Yisrael. V'itzrichan ha-kosev, which means the kosev means the pasuk in Chumash, itzrichan requires sreifa. Okay, it's a very unique case where the Torah requires burning. By the way, on the side, I want to tell you this is unique for another reason. Not only does the Torah require burning, but the Torah requires what's called search and find. Meaning you have to look for the Avodah Zarah, and you have to completely eradicate Avodah Zarah from Eretz Yisrael. It's not enough to say, well, I'll wait till, you know, till somebody comes along and says, oh, that tree is Avodah Zarah. I have to actually go from place to place and seek out Avodah Zarah in order to destroy it. And that's based on the pasuk of Ashreyem. Again, Ashreyem means the possessive form of the word Asherah. So the word Asherah is a biblical term. Ashreyem means those trees that they worship. Tisrafun ba'esh. The Torah says it has to be burned. Velulav tzarech shiur. And a lulav has a minimum shiur of 4 tefachim. Vahai, but this lulav that comes from an Asherah, where the Torah says that when you destroy the nations that occupy the land, and you have to destroy the Asheros, and you have to set fire to them, they have to go up in flames, is high command the michta shiura. It's as if the shiur was completely destroyed, undermined. Cave under l'sreifa koi, because it's omeg l'sreifa. L'sreifa koi is the Aramaic form of omeg l'sreifa. It is designated for burning.
Even if it wasn't.
It wasn't burnt yet, otherwise he couldn't use it as a lulav. He can't use a burnt lulav. And the Mishnah wouldn't address that case. But he used the lulav before it was burnt. But since it's designated for burning, meaning the mitzvah that requires burning with regard to this Asherah, and we're talking about the Asherah of Moshe Rabbeinu at the time of Kibush Eretz Yisrael, when the land was conquered, those Asheros have to be burned by Eish Tisrafu, the Torah says. Ashreyam Tisrafu by Eish. And therefore we activate the principle of what? Kitusei Mechta Shiura. And here, by the way, it would seem from this Mishnah, the way the Gemara is interpreting it, that the shear of a lulav defines the lulav itself. You know, we had a whole discussion about a dried up lulav. You know, maybe if you have no other lulav, you know, you'll take it, but shasad chak, you know, it's circumstances that are pressing, maybe it's still called a lulav. But our Mishnah seems to assume that once the lulav has no shear, it's not a lulav at all. In other words, when we talk about a lulav, we're not just defining a species, but we're also defining a certain shear. And in the case of an Asherah, and specifically Asherah de Moshe, because it's omeg l'sreifa, as Rashi calls it, l'sreifa koi, it's designated to be burnt, therefore ketusei mechta shiurin, it's a lulav without a shear. I don't care how beautiful it is, I don't care how tall it is, it's not a lulav. And therefore it's possible. Ah, what about Rava? Rava just finished telling us that a lulav shall avod is Zorah, im natal. Everybody im natal, what does Rava say? Kosher. Why? So apparently, if Rava is not talking about Nasherah de Moshe, and if Rava is not talking about Nasherah de Moshe, he's talking about Christopher, who's now worshipping this lulav tree outside our door. And then the Yid comes along and takes the lulav from this tree. Rav is talking about that case where the Torah doesn't require sreifa. If the Torah doesn't require sreifa, Rav insists that it's not considered, it doesn't come under the, we don't activate the principle of ketusei mechta shiur. And again, we're going to go through the highlights of this Tosis, because Tosis is not a happy camper, because he thinks that even if there's no bits of sreifa, if you have to destroy Avodah Zarah in another form, maybe not in the, you know, most radical, profound form of burning it, but you have to bury it, for example, which is called gniza, that too is enough to generate ketusei mechta shiura. Because if halachically you have no possibility of using this object because it was worship, then it's considered destroyed. And if it's considered destroyed, it's ketusei mechta shiura. So again, Rabbo said, we're only halfway there. What we know from Rava is the following. That if you're talking about Asherah de Moshe, where the Torah specifically requires what? Sreifa, then we apply the principle of ketusei mechta shiura. If we're talking about Christopher, who worships a tree, then although that tree is a tree of Avodah Zarah, doesn't have the same status as Asherah Demotion. There's no requirement of Sreifa. And therefore, Rava says we don't apply the principle of Ketuseh Mechta Shira. And therefore, if you take a lulav out of Christopher's tree, then L'chatchila, we're not going to allow you to use it. But if you went ahead and you used it, then Kasha, you yotzei the mitzvah. So now we have to ask two questions. Question number one is, why is the halacha discouraged using it L'chatchila? And question number two, why is it kosher b'di'eved post facto if you went ahead and you used it? After all, it still is Avodah Zarah.
And are there others who hold that this type of Avodah Zarah is an Asherah? This is Rava's opinion.
Well, keep in mind that Rava, in order to defend himself against the Mishnah, because Rava can't contradict the Mishnah, he has to assume that a lulav shel Avodah Zarah is not an Asherah. Because once you use the word Asherah, you're in deep trouble. Because the Mishnah says that a lulav shel Asherah is completely possible, and Rava says it not al kosher. So we're going to have to assume that Rava is talking about some sort of a scenario which is not an Asherah. And why is it an Asherah? That we have to figure out. Okay. Now we have to introduce another concept here. What did I do with the thing? So? Oh, okay, that's halfway. Where's the marker?
That's great. It's under the book.
Under the book. No, keep it. Now we have to introduce a concept called beetle. We're familiar with this word in a different context. Not in Avodah Zarah, but when? On Erev Pesach, right? We do beetle on our chametz. But there's something called beetle Avodah Zarah. Bitul Avodah Zarah means it's a little bit similar to a concept that we mentioned last week called Shinui. You remember when the Goslin steals something and then he makes a change in the object, in the structure of the object. Right? He does Agad with a stolen Hadas, or we mentioned a case where he steals grains and he grinds them and makes a flour out of them. You remember all this? This concept of Shinui. So there's a similar concept, almost parallel, in Avodah Zarah. It's not called Shinui, it's called Bittul. The reason why we use the term Bittul is because we have to indicate that not only is there a structural change in the object, which is Shinui, but Bittul means that even if there was no structural change, if you do an act which... Okay, I'm looking for the English word... which denigrates the Avodah Zarah, even though it doesn't make a radical change in the object, but it's enough to indicate that you denigrate the object. So that in Hilchos Shinui, it would not qualify as a Shinui. It's not radical enough of a change in the structure of the object to qualify as a Shinui, but nevertheless, it might be bittul because it entails denigrating the idol. So let's say, for example, if the idol has a nose, and you would chip off the end of the nose. By the way, does anybody here feel a tremendous desire, a craving, lust to worship an idol? Why is that so? The Gemara tells us, Rav Ashi said that if he lived at the time of idol worship, he would have lifted up his skirts and ran to worship an idol. Who could imagine worshiping an idol?
Didn't Rabbi say on Shabbos?
Oh, you were here. Yeah. Very good. Wow, you heard me on Shabbos. Go a couple. It's only because the Anshei Knesset HaGdola prayed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be mevatel the Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah. The Yetzirah plays such tricks on us that it can convince us. And the most disgusting of all Avodah Zarah is Baal Pa'or. And I once gave a shiur where I tried to explain why Baal Pa'or is such a powerful concept. And why the Yetzirah would, you know, we almost lost the battle. We almost lost our whole nation because of Baal Pa'or. And it's the most disgusting, repulsive Avodah Zarah. But there's a lot more than meets the eye. Anyway, so he chops off the nose of an idol. Okay? Even if he makes a very minute or limited kind of change in the physical structure, it might not be enough to qualify as a Shinui, but it's denigrating. That's called Bittul. Now, if we were learning Masechta Avodah Zarah, which would take us another year, right, then we'd have to know who's capable of doing Bittul and when. You know, is it the person who worshipped the idol? Could it be you and I? Anybody can do the Bittul. And there may be different categories of Bittul. So it becomes really complicated. That's why this Tosfos is so long. But what we do know is the following. That Bittul only applies, listen carefully, to the case of an Avodah Zarah shel Nachri. Okay? Nachri is synonymous with a goy, right? So there are two exclusions, meaning there are two cases that don't fit under this category, and therefore they don't lend themselves to Bittul. Okay? One category is called Avodah Zarah shel Yisrael she'avad. She'avad means, with an ayin, he, a Jew, never worshipped the idol. Once a Jew worships the idol, then the principle is Elo Bittul Olamis. It means that forevermore there's no Bittul. Okay? Now we have a different case, which is excluded from Bittul, and that's where the guy worshipped the idol, but then the idol was passed on, the transfer of ownership, to the Israel. So if either A or B happened, there's no Bittul. A, the Avodah Zarah was worshipped by Israel, or B, even if it was worshipped by a guy, but the Avodah Zarah is owned by the Israel. Possession itself makes it into Avodah Zarah shel Israel, and blockades, undermines Bittul. Good? I mean, just get... We're not learning Avodah Zarah, but this is the...
Repeat that.
So again, if either A or B, either the Avodah Zarah was worshipped by a Jew, Ein lo Bittul Olamis, or alternatively, if the guy transferred ownership over his own Buddha doll, you know, over to... Well, again, Buddhism is a whole issue, but let's say, what would be a classical...
Like Shiva, the Indian...
It's called Shiva?
Shiva, yeah.
Okay,
Indian
Shiva.
Hindu idol.
Yeah. It's amazing what percentage of the population of the world actually worships idols today. So I don't know. You know, I wonder how successful the Anshei Knesset Gedolah were in Mevatelim from Avodah Zarah. So again, if either A, the idol was worshipped by a Jew, or B, the object was worshipped by a guy, but it's in the possession of a Jew, in both of those cases there's no bit. Okay. So Tosfos says the following. When a guy worships an Asherah or any sort of Avodah Zarah, then we don't apply the principle of Kitusei Mechta Shiurah. This is Rava. Tosfos is revealing the secret of Rava. Why does Rava say that I can take a lulav shel Avodah Zarah and I can use it to fulfill the mitzvah of lulav, not l'chatchila? Again, l'chatchila, Rashi says lo yitol. No, you take a look at Rashi. No, I mean to say Rashi explains lo yitol. What does lo yitol mean? Demois ligavoa. That's about I'd say 10 lines up from the bottom. So mois ligavoa means, and this makes sense according to those Rishon the Ritva, who says that a lulav comes like right in front of the Ribono Shelom. It's Ritzu. That's like almost like a din of karma. But anyway, not for now. But I'm just saying that to take something that was worshipped as an idol or in the context of idolatry and then bring it as a mitzvah, you know, that same object, that's mois. Mois means it's repulsive. But that doesn't undermine the mitzvah. And therefore, im not al kosher. What happened to Kitusei Mechta Shiurah? Why does the Gemara need to say that, you know, which lulav is absolutely possible in Avodah Zarah? That's only Asherah de Moshe, because there's Lesreifa Koi. Forget about Lesreifa Koi. Why don't you say that you have to destroy Avodah Zarah, and maybe not in Sreifa, you don't have to burn it, but you have to get rid of it, you know, but bury it, you know, deep below the ground. Why doesn't that generate the principle of Kitusei Mechta Shiurah? So Tosfos says the answer to that is Bittul. That since the Torah says that very idol, if you do Bittul on it, you chop off the tip of the nose, then you're allowed to do whatever you want with it. It becomes absolutely mutter. It goes from one extreme to the other, from becoming Avodah Zarah to being Heter. Therefore, Tosfos says you don't apply the principle of Kitusei Mechta Shiurah. Now watch what goes on. There's time T1, time T2, and time T3. At time T1, the guy worshipped, you know, Christopher went out and he worshipped the date palm tree, right? At time T3, he did Bittul. He started ripping it apart, whatever he did, right? At time T2, between these two, the Yisrael used that lulav for the mitzvah of Lekachtem Lachem. And Rava says he fulfilled his mitzvah. He shouldn't have done it, but he fulfilled his mitzvah. So I don't get it. Tosis is saying that there's no Ketuse Mechdash Yira because of Bittul. But the Bittul took place after he used the lulav. So what does Tosis mean by Bittul? You have to add one word here I'm looking for. It starts with a P and has an O. Exactly, the potential for Bittul. In other words, Tosis says that there are two categories of Avodah Zorah. There's an Avodah Zorah which is Elo Bittul Olamis, and that's going to be the case of Asherah de Moshe. We'll get back to that in just a minute. There's no Bittul whatsoever. It doesn't lend itself to Bittul. That's where we're going to apply the principle of Ketuse Mechdash Yira. And then there's an Avodah Zorah that lends itself to Bittul. Has Bittul taken place yet? No. But the very potential for Bittul means that this object is still intact. The very fact that I can salvage, save the object by just doing X, which is called Bittul, that gives the object a certain tsura to it. It has a certain... It has a reality to it. In other words, its physical reality still exists. And I'll prove it to you, because that very same object, if I do Bittul to it, then it's mutter. So the physical object is not gone from the face of the earth. In the case of chametz, I don't know if we apply ketuse mechdash yira, because in the case of chametz, what you could do is you can do Bittul on the chametz, and then after Pesach, you can eat the chametz. So maybe that's also a potential of Bittul, and therefore we would not apply the principle of ketuse mechdash yira. But what we see here is that Tosis is applying this rule of if it lends itself to Bittul. But now Tosis has a problem. Christopher worshipped in his backyard, he worshipped his Asherah. But who's using the lulav from that Asherah? Mm-hmm. A Yid, right? So as soon as a Yid takes possession,
it's not eligible for Bittul.
It's no longer eligible for Bittul. Ain't no Bittul alamis. Again, it wasn't the Jew who worshipped the Asherah, but the Jew he's a very naive, innocent Jew. He just wants to use it for the mitzvah of lulav. But the problem is that the Torah says, Lekachtem Lachem, which means he's got to own it. The very moment he owns the lulav, it becomes what? Elo Bittul Shel Olamis. If according to Tosis, the whole reason for Ketuse Mechdash Yira is because, I'm sorry, the whole reason we suspend the principle of Ketuse Mechdash Yira is because of the potential of Bittul, then when there's no potential of Bittul, for example, an Asherah de Moshe has no potential of Bittul, the Torah says, go into the land and burn the Asherah. Burn, baby, burn. And it doesn't matter one iota whether it's Bittul or not, it won't change. There's a separate din of Nusreifa, the Torah says, Ba'esh Tisrafa. No Bittul. If that be the case, the lulav is possible. But Rava, he's not talking about Asherah de Moshe. If Rava's not talking about Asherah de Moshe, then it lends itself to Bittul. Even though the Jew used the lulav for the mitzvah before the Bittul took place, it doesn't matter. If it lends itself to Bittul, then it has a stamina, it has an existence, it has a material substance to it. We don't apply Ketuse Mechdash Yira. But that's only because who worshipped this idol?
Christopher.
But now, who's taking the lulav? It's not Christopher, unless he did Gerus, right? And then hopefully he got a different name. It's Reb Yid. If Reb Yid is taking this lulav, then it's no longer an Avodah Zorah shel Nachri, it now became an Avodah Zorah shel Yisrael and Elo Bittul Olamis. So how could Rava get away with the principle of Imnot al Kosher in the case of an Avodah Zorah, Lulav shel Avodah Zorah? What do you say, Ben? You have an answer to this question?
Before the answer or potential answer, I'm wondering if he took it Beshoga, he had no idea this was worshipped. He's innocent, as you said earlier, he's naive, he takes it, he buys it.
It's an issue of possession over Avodah Zorah. Mm-hmm. If a Jew possesses Avodah Zorah, it becomes the Avodah Zorah of a Jew. and it doesn't lend itself to bittul. If it doesn't lend itself to bittul, we have to apply the principle of kitusei mechta shura, and now we're in trouble because Rava says im not al kosher. How can he say im not al kosher?
Does it make a difference that the lulav is no longer connected to the tree?
Okay, so that'll come down the line. I thought, Michael, you were going to say the following. Does it make a difference whether we're talking about the first day of Sukkot or the other 6 days of Sukkot? This is Tosus's breakthrough. Tosus says that when Rava says in not al kosher, he's not talking about the first day of Sukkot, because on the first day of Sukkot, by definition, he must own the lulav because of lechem. And if he owns the lulav, it becomes an avodah zarah shel Yisrael. And avodah zarah shel Yisrael doesn't lend itself to bittul. And if it doesn't lend itself to bittul, then we apply the principle of kedusha mechta shura. So how can Rava say I'm not al kosher?
Because he borrowed.
Well, that was a string of chagadim with about 6 different premises. But if you add all those premises together and you turn them out, there's no possibility of justifying Rava's conclusion that I'm not al kosher on the first day of Sukkot. Because according to Tosfos Shita, what's going to determine, what's the hinge which will determine whether we apply kedusha mechta shura or not?
Ownership.
It all depends upon whether it's bittul or not. And what determines whether it's bittul or not? Is it an avodah zarah shel nachri or is it an avodah zarah shel Yisrael? If it's an avodah zarah shel nachri, it lends itself to bittul. So presumably, Rav is talking about avodah zarah shel nachri. And if it's avodah zarah shel nachri, the potential for bittul is there, and therefore we don't apply the principle of kedusha mechta shura. But now you got a problem, because on the first day of Yantiv, it's avodah zarah shel Yisrael. By definition, it has to be avodah zarah shel Yisrael. Because otherwise, you can't even entertain the mitzvah. If the Torah says lachem. So Tosfos comes up with a radical chiddush. The whole discussion of the sugya here is not about the first day of Sukkot, it's about the other 6 days of Sukkot. And Rabbeinu Tam, who is the most radical of all Balei Tosfos, all of Shas, he's the revolutionary thinker, very independent thinker, Rabbeinu Tam. He can't buy onto this Tosfos. He can't accept the principle or the premise that this whole sugya is talking about the second day and beyond. So Rabbeinu Tam says the following: the potential for bittul is not enough. You need bittul, what we call befal, in actuality. Meaning, as long as there's no bittul, then this avodah zarah has to be destroyed in one form or another. Maybe not b'sreifa, but through gniza, etc. And therefore, kedusha mechta shura. So now we have a real problem. Rabbeinu Tam pulls the rug out of under the whole Tosfos. The whole thesis of Tosfos is that the reason why Rava says im not al kosher and there's no kedusha mechta shura is because of the potential for bittul. Counsel of Rabbeinu Tam, he says that's wrong. And he has many rayas to prove that potential for bittul is not the same as bittul. Until you do the bittul, it's kedusha mechta shura. So how could Rava say that you take a lulav? So this is where Michael's svara comes in. He wants to suggest, Rabbi Nutam, that ktsitsa, which means cutting down the lulav from the asherah, is radical enough of a change from asherah to lulav to constitute bittul. And that Rava's entire sugya is built on bittul, but not the potential of bittul.
It already happened.
Exactly. Bittul before. And the Mela says, Rabbeinu Tam, even on the first day, Rava would say, im not al kosher. Why? Because he did bittul. Now this raises a lot of feathers. You know, what is bittul? I mean, to say, you know, to take a lulav off an asherah tree, I don't know if that's derogatory, you know, that doesn't denigrate it. But again, you have to know a lot more about avodah zarah. They worship the tree. It has an idol. There's so much psychology in Masechet Avodah Zarah about the psychology of idol worship, and the asherah has a special status as an asherah. So I don't want to give any modern paganistic examples from Christianity, but there's one night of the year, for sure, where they're all out there with their trees, right? And I'm wondering, you know, what the halachas are in Christianity if you break off one of the branches of the tree. Does anybody know? Or we could Google that. Maybe they don't care. I'm telling you they care, Michael. I don't know. I'm just telling you, I don't know beans about Christianity. But Levi Omerli, my intuition tells me, that if you break off a tree from a Christmas tree, it taint the same. It doesn't have the same status. You got to have that beautiful tree, you know, with all the bells on it, and the colored stuff. Anyway.
No, hold on.
But in any event, it was good for pedagogical reasons. Whether what I told you is worth a dime or not, I don't know. But just listen, Rabbi Tullis. Yeah,
John. How does Rabbi Tam deal with Ein Lo Bittul Olamus?
Ein Lo Bittul Olamus would only apply in a case where the tree was sold to Yisrael and they broke off the branch. But Rabbi Tam describes a situation in which the Jew bought a lulav. So what happened? The guy worshipped the Asherah, and then he broke off the lulav and sold it to the Yisrael. In that case, the bittul took place before it became Avodah Zarah Shel Yisrael, and therefore there's no ketusei method.
But that's going to apply to all Asherah situations, meaning by definition, every time you have a tree and you have a lulav, you've at some point broken it down, so then at all times.
Which is Rabbeinu Tam's one-off-it, but again,
which then,
but the questionable premise of Rabbeinu Tam is that is breaking off a lulav considered bittul?
But then the question would be, why would the missionary even bring it up? Because there's no scenario, I think. Where
no, just Asherah Shel Moshe. What's unique about Asherah Shel Moshe? Because Asherah Shel Moshe doesn't lend itself to bittul. Now, Rabbi Osser, we have to ask another question on this whole sugya. The whole sugya, as I told you at the outset, revolves around one principle called Kitusei Mechtashim. That the destruction of Avodah Zarah means it doesn't have a shear. But look, Rabbi Osser, there's another problem, a totally different problem, in the case of Avodah Zarah, which has nothing to do with the destruction of the Avodah Zarah. And that's called Isurei Hanoah. Avodah Zarah is also Hanoah. You're not allowed to have any benefit whatsoever. And this has nothing to do with destroying it or burying it or whatever it is. You cannot have derived benefits from Avodah Zarah. So somebody asks the following question, and I'm going to ask you if you can guess who that somebody is after you hear the question. What does Rava mean in Not Al Kosh? Rava says that this lulav was worshipped as an Avodah Zarah. It was used in the context of idol worship. And Rava says, nevertheless, he can fulfill his mitzvah of L'tachtem Lachem. Wait a minute. The very moment he fulfills his mitzvah, he's violated Isurei Hanoah. He's benefited from Avodah Zarah. So forget about the whole issue of Ketusei Mechta. Alright, you solved the problem of Ketusei Mechta Shiur. But what about the more basic problem of violating Isurei Hanoah by benefiting from this lulav, which is an Avodah Zarah Dika lulav? Who asks this question? Not Berzon. Rashi asks. And Rashi gives an amazing answer. Let's look at Rashi inside. V'im not al kosher. It's about 10 lines up from the bottom. V'afal gav. Whatever you see, v'afal gav, it's almost like v'im tomar or v'tema. It's a question. V'afal gav de isurei hanohu. And here you put a question mark. How could it be that he can derive the benefit of using this lulav for his mitzvah, his obligation? Lulav shel Avodah Zarah is clearly Isurei Hanoah. You're not allowed to derive any benefit. And this has nothing to do with Asherah, has nothing to do with Asherah de Moshe, it doesn't matter whether Christopher worshipped or the Asherah, it's irrelevant.
According to Rabbi Tam, before he used it for his mitzvah.
Yeah, according to Rabbeinu Tam, this kasha would not be a kasha. You're very right, Jerry. But let's go back to Tosas. Tosas says it's an Avodah Zarah, and how he could use it. Tosas has potential for bittul. Forget about potential for bittul. I have a more basic problem here. He's violating the Isurei Hanoah. Now, I don't know if Rashi has in mind the principle of mitzvah bar avera, or Rashi just means to say that for some reason, I don't know why, the Hanoah here, once violated, because he has no right to benefit from, that's going to undermine the mitzvah. I don't know. But look at Rashi's answer. And if you have a notebook, you must copy this over into your notebook, because this is what I call a Shas principle. It appears all over the place. And we're lucky enough to see it here. Says Rashi, and these are the four key words, the mitzvos lav lehenos nit. So for example, the Gemara says in Masechta Yevamos, you have a nal. A nal is a shoe, a very specific kind of shoe that's used in a ceremony called chalitza. Okay, I'm not going to go into that, it'll take an hour or two. And this nal was used as a shoe for an idol. So it's part of the idol and it's called Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara says that you yotze the mitzvah of chalitza. Why? Because mitzvos lav lehenos ni. Which literally means that the mitzvah is not given for hanah. So for example, the Gemara talks about a sukkah. If let's say he takes a neder that he won't have any hanah from this particular hut, you know, there's schach over it, can he be yotze his mitzvah of sukkah? And the Gemara vacillates back and forth whether you apply a principle called mitzvah lav lehenos nitnu in this case of a sukkah. Then the Gemara is going to talk about a shofar. Let's say there was an Isra Hanah on the shofar. It was called the shofar shal ola. Right? You know, an animal that was consecrated for the Mizbeach is osur banoi. You're not allowed to have any personal benefit from it. An ola especially. You don't even eat the basar. You know, it's purely consumed on the Mizbeach. And now he took the shofar off the ola. You know, the horn. And he blows it.
Isn't that Me'ilah?
Oh, so for sure he violates Me'ilah, but the question is, can he be yotze in the midst of shofar? And has he violated this violation of Isra Hanah, and therefore that would negate and undermine his mitzvah? The Gemara says mitzvah slav lehenos. So Rashi tells us, what does it mean mitzvah slav lehenos? Rashi says klomar ein kiu mitzvahs. The kiyum, the fulfillment of a mitzvah, hanas haguf. It's not considered as if his body benefited from it. Ela, but rather it's avodas evid l'rabo. It's a servant who's obedient and he's fulfilling service to his master. Very interesting, because this reminds us a little bit of a mishnah of Antignos Ish Socho, in the famous mishnah in Amos. We don't serve God because we want to get benefit out of it, but rather we serve God out of total obedience. And Rashi says that that's not called an act for the sake of Hanah. The fact that he gets a Kiyuma mitzvah, he gets brownie points because he fulfilled his obligation, that's not called Hanah. So I just want to mention here, you know, one of the great Rishonim, especially on Masechta Sukkah, is the Ritva. And the Ritva tries to embellish this Rashi. And he says the following. That there are two types of Hanah in Halach. When Halach talks about benefiting from, he says there's Hanah Migufo Shel Isuri Hanah. And that's prohibited. That's a no-no. And then there's Hanah, which is a result of Gufo Shel Isuri Hanah, where the object doesn't give him any benefit, but just through the object he gets benefit. So again, let's go over. There's direct pleasure or benefit from the object. If the object is also by Hanah, you violate Isuri Hanah. And then there's indirect benefit, where you use the object in such a way that you get benefit from it. It's like if I take a train ride, I didn't get any benefit from the ticket that allows me, the conductor takes my ticket. And once I bring the ticket, I produce the ticket, the conductor allows me to hop on the bus. You know, but it's the bus that gives me the hanah, not the ticket. Comes along the Ritva, and he suggests that when you use an object that's osur banah for the sake of a mitzvah, you're not benefiting from the object per se. It's just that the object becomes a means to an end in which you get benefit from it. And that's not a violation of Isuri Hanah. When Rashi says mitzvah slav lehenos nitnu, What Rashi means to say is that the benefit that you get qualitatively is not considered a benefit. Why? Because the qualitative essential definition of benefit when the Torah prohibits hana is hana mi gufo shel dover. If you use the gufo shel dover and indirectly through the guf, you enjoy some benefit, that's not a violation of Yisuri Hanor.
So in the Ola, okay, in the case of the Ola, if you like try to fulfill a Sudas Mitzvah by eating some of the meat from the Ola, that would be a problem. But if you used it for shofar, because that's indirect, there's not bodily pleasure, that
excellent.
Might actually be
excellent.
A benefit.
And that's the Gemara about Sukkah. The Gemara vacillates back and forth. What is Sukkah? Is Sukkah a mitzvah just physically to sit in the Sukkah, or is Sukkah a mitzvah to enjoy the Sukkah? When the Torah tells you to enjoy it, that's what gives you the mitzvah. So it's the benefit from the Sukkah that sets up the mitzvah. The Ritva would make sense in the case of a lulav, because in the case of a lulav of Yisuri Anah, namely in the case of lulav Shalom Onesora, there I'm only using the lulav as a tool, as a vehicle to achieve my kima mitzvah. But what happens when the Torah tells you to have benefit from something? That seemingly the essence of the mitzvah is to benefit, is to enjoy the hanor. Then the Gemara says it's not so simple to apply the principle of mitzvah slav lehenos, because what are you going to tell me? Well, I'm not having hanor from this mitzvah. I'm getting a benefit that's indirect. But the Torah itself commands you to have hanor. That's the whole essence of the mitzvah. So what is Sukkah? You remember that in Sukkah there's a principle called Teshvu, that you have to live in the Sukkah. It means you have to enjoy the Sukkah. You have to benefit from the Sukkah. In fact, in many countries in the world, it's almost impossible for 6 months out of the year, maybe even longer, to be mekayim in the midst of Sukkah. It is so freezing in the Sukkah that you don't benefit from the Sukkah. On the contrary, you'd be much better off in your house. Well, it's always to be better off in your house. But at least here in Eretz Yisrael, in most cases, a few years ago we had a downpour of rain on Sukkot, but it's almost rare here in Eretz Yisrael. You know, I've been here for, I don't know how many years I'm here already, but 90% of the Sukkot, we don't even see the cloud, you know, hardly see a cloud in the sky. It's so gishmak. And that gishmak is what defines the mitzvah of Sukkot. And if you're sitting in the Sukkot and you're freezing, or you're getting attacked by mosquitoes, then get yourself out of the Sukkot and go back into your house. Now you have in Simchas Yontif in your house. So there are rare mitzvahs where the essence of the mitzvah is the hanah that you get from the mitzvah. So the Gemara, for example, in the Darim, a fascinating Gemara wants to know, if a man takes a neder, hanas tashmishe halai, he says to his wife that I take a neder, a vow that I won't enjoy the benefit of a sexual relationship, of intimacy. And the Gemara wants to know, can he still have the relationship because of the principle of mitzvah slav lehenos? So the Gemara wants to say, well, here, the essence of the mitzvah is to have the hanor. So you can't separate the mitzvah from the hanor. But I just want to add one point of my own here. And I don't think that Rashi had in mind this ritva. The ritva is a very nice shtickle Torah. I like it a lot. It's very profound. But I don't think that's what Rashi had in mind, because look at the end of Rashi. Rashi says, Ela avodas eved l'ravo. Do you see those last, how many words? Those last four words of Rashi. Those words are totally superfluous according to the Ritva. They don't belong here. According to the Ritva, the nature of the mitzvah is to do a certain act, and you use the lulav for that act of ulakachtim of netilas lulav, and then you get a side benefit, you get a kiyuma mitzvah, you get brownie points, as we said. But that's an indirect hanor. It's not hanor migufo shel shalisa. According to the Ritva, there's no need to add those extra four words. Apparently, Rashi's on a whole different track over here. Rashi's talking about what? If you know basic psychology, what word in psychology is so basic that I think Rashi is referring to?
Subservience?
Motivation. What motivates you? Why are you taking this lulav? So normally in Isuri Hanor, you do it because you want to have Hanor from it. Rashi's saying, no. Divest this action of any Hanor. Strip it of any benefit I get, and I would still do the mitzvah. Why? Because ke'avodas eved l'rav. What moves me to do this mitzvah is not anor. Isuri anor, Rashi says, means I have to take something and benefit from it. But if I don't take something, and the benefit is there, but that's not what motivates me, I'm interested not in... For example, the Gemara says, you'll be amazed if you don't know this Gemara. The Gemara says that mochrei ksus, that means garment sellers, are allowed to wear shatnez. What used to happen, not like in our day where you transport, what time is it? Oh, we still have 2 minutes. So in our day, you want to transport something from place X to place Y, so you have great trucks and everything. In those days, they didn't have these trucks. So what they did was, I'm just reminding myself of a children's book we used to, the kids used to love it, but I can't remember the name of it, with the caps, one on top of the other. Do you remember that?
Cap with a hat.
No. No, it's a cap seller. It's someone who sells caps.
Red hats or something.
Yeah, it's beautiful. The illustrations, yeah. You know, they have one cap on top of the other, and they show you how he walks and he moves with the, you know, 25 caps on top. I forgot the name of the book. The kids used to love that book. So in the old days, what happened was that garment sellers would wear their begadim one on top of the other in order to transport them. Made it easier to go, a peddler would go from one town to the next. And the Gemara allows him to wear shatnez. You know, he's selling shatnez to goyim, and he's transporting it by wearing it. So the Gemara says, but shatnez is also about, no, you're not allowed to wear it and warm up your body. So the Gemara says, we're talking about b'yemos hachama, during the summer months. And he's not motivated at all to get any benefit from it, and therefore he doesn't violate Isra Anah. But you see very clearly that the issue of Isra Anah means I take something in order to benefit from it. Here I'm wearing it, I'm not taking it to benefit. I'm taking it in order to what? To transport it from place to place, to facilitate my ability to sell it. That's not a violation of Isra Anah.
But if you happen to get benefit from it, even though it wasn't your intention to get benefit from it,
then that's not Isra Anah. Why?
Still, right?
Because there's nothing pulling you to the object for the sake of Anah. Like, for example, the Gemara talks, I'll give you, Michael, just want to tell you one last thing before I forget. You're walking by a bakery, and they're baking Isra Anah. Let's say that they're baking, they're frying, you know, what is it called? McDonald's, what are they called? Cheeseburgers, right? So you're passing by cheeseburger. Now, I don't know, is it a good smell? I'm not sure. Let's say a cheeseburger is a good smell. I'm assuming, right? The Gemara talks about, in Avodah Zarah, in their temples, they used to do incense. You remember they used to burn incense. So he's walking by Avodah Zarah, you know, I'm taking a stroll, and I have to pass by a temple of Avodah Zarah. I don't know if he should have been doing that, but anyway, so he gets the smell of the incense. So the Gemara says that it depends. If he has no other way of getting from point X to point Y, so it's low efshar, and he has to pass by the temple, then that's called Hanah Sheba Lo Li Adam Shalom Ritzono, against his will. And that's not called a violation of Isra Anah. If on the other hand he could have taken a shorter road and he dafka went that way, then we assume he was taking the incense, so to speak. Not physically, but taking the smell. You know, that's a really, but you see very clearly that when it comes to Isra Anah, it's a question of whether you were motivated to take it, to take in this benefit or not. That's what Rashi is saying about mitzvahs. In mitzvahs, we're going to apply the principle of mitzvahs lav lanos nitnu. He's not motivated to take the hanah and enjoy it. He's motivated because he's an eved who's committed to his rav. Yeah, Michael?
So, presumably we're talking about hanah b'olam hazeh, not hanah b'olam haba.
Yeah, that's not an issue. The issue here is hanah b'olam hazeh. And if he's motivated to get a benefit in this world, because, you know, the Chazal say that when you do a mitzvah, you benefit not only the next world, but also this world. The Karen, you know, the main principle is left for the next world, although there are about 25 exceptions to that rule. I once gave a shiur on that here. There are, maybe I'm exaggerating, but I came up with at least 18 cases in which you can benefit in this world and get rewarded for a mitzvah. But the general rule is that the reward is designated for the next world. So Rabbi Osa, let's just in 2 minutes summarize what we learned today. Again, in Gemara, we covered 2 lines of Gemara, and I apologize, because usually I want to do it, but there was no other way out. We entered into a veldt, a world unto itself of Avodah Zarah. And the summary is as follows. Point number one is that the only way we could reconcile Rava, who says that in Not Al Kosher, with the Mishnah of Lulav Shal Asherah, is by introducing a concept called Asherah de Moshe. Only in the case of Asherah de Moshe is the lulav posel, and even b'dieved he wasn't yotze. And the reason for that is because the Torah says that an Asherah de Moshe is designated for what? Sreifa. And if it's l'sreifa koi, kitusei mechta shiru. all other forms of avodah zara, in a guy case, in a non-Jew case, lend themselves to a different form, not to sreifa, and that could be circumvented, and therefore it has the status of a lulav and a notal kosh. And the last point that we made was that lechora, this whole sugya contradicts the principle of yisuri anna, because once it was worshipped, then you're not allowed to benefit from it. The answer is, Rashi says, mitzvah slav lehenes. Okay then, everyone should have a wonderful day, and thank you so much.
But interestingly, like the Ritva, where the Ritva holds on this is enough. You don't even need the, like Rashi's almost like more open to it, because I think in the case of Lulav, everyone would agree there's no additional benefit that anyone's taking for themselves. There's no first order benefit, right? So even though the Rashi will say that
he's not forming his body,
right? When there is a first order benefit, as long as you didn't do it for that benefit, you can have it. But in the case of Lulav, it's not even relevant because there is no first order benefit to begin with. You're only doing it for the mitzvah, right? So,
but I would say the following. Like, that's what I would say, which is that Rashi understands that some sort of qualitative benefit, even if it's immaterial. It's what's the word in English? It's ephemeral, whatever that word is. You know what word I'm talking about? Ethereal, whatever that word is, right? It's abstract.
Yeah.
It's not physical. Rashi says it's still included in Yisuri Ano, and therefore Rashi has a problem where the Ritva doesn't. The Ritva wants to see you in order to violate Yisuri Ano.
So
have physical pleasure directly from the object. You know, I use this soap and I clean my body from it. I use oil and I smear it on my body. I have food and I eat it.
The Ritva doesn't care about the abstract concept.
According to the Ritva, it's only physical, because once it becomes abstract, it becomes indirect.
Yeah.
And it's not migufa shaldover. Rashi would say, even if it's not migufa shaldover, it's still awesome.
Right.
But the question is, what motivates you?
Right.
Are you motivated because you want the hana, or the hana comes to you as a result of the action?
Okay.
Okay, good. It's a nice sukkah, you know. Again, it's not for quick learning. You know, you're entering into a whole world. I don't know how many new concepts we touched on today.
Can I ask a favor? Can you write the four words for...
What, Mrs. Lavla Henderson?
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that for you because Rashi does it for you. So you just have to underline the Rashi. This is your Gemara?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're allowed to, or if you just want to copy it from Rashi, you'll save me the hassle. De mitzvos, lav, lehenos, mit. Those are the four words. Okay, then?
No.